This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 255 in the series. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with our state representative, Jeffrey Roy. We had our conversation via conference bridge to adhere to the social distancing requirement of this pandemic period. We started by talking about the weekend and trying to take a break from COVID-19. The family of foxes that briefly lived in his backyard. The work of the legislature and how that is progressing during this pandemic. The state budget in particular is starting to be worked on by the House later than normal, and it's likely that the entire state budget timeline will be later than normal. We talk about legislation on enabling voting by mail for the state primary in September, and then the regular election in November. We also talk about Jeff's work on the Higher Education Committee, and how that is helping to prepare for the broader discussion on what the state can do for higher ed en masse, the economic impact of higher education on the entire economy, and then segued into the arts and culture arena, which also provides considerable economic value to our Commonwealth. The recording itself runs about 40 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Jeff.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters and Franklin Public Radio, WFPR-FM. Today we're being joined by our state representative, Jeff Roy. Jeff, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
It is indeed good to be up and about, albeit even the weather is not cooperating. But, you know, in these times, we take what we can.
Exactly. Exactly. I know that the sun is coming and I know that good news is on the horizon. So I'm feeling good.
You may have heard the story, but I traveled to Kenya last year and their phrasing effectively redoes kind of the Hakuna Matata that Disney popularized. Sure. It truly is a thing for the Kenyans. They phrase it in their words in terms of the sun will rise tomorrow.
There you go.
Which, you know, absolutely. So to a certain extent, you know, it's okay. If they don't get it today, the sun will rise tomorrow.
Those are words to live by.
Absolutely. So did you have a decent weekend?
Yeah, I was trying to, take some time off and step away from, yes. COVID and other sure. matters. And that's simply impossible in this day and age. But, you know, I was happy to be able to dethatch and mow my lawn. So there's
a
great thing.
Good. And if you had any yard waste accumulated, now at least Beaver Street Recycling Center is open on, I think it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday for yard waste only. So, oh,
well, there you go.
See?
Luckily, I live in the woods.
So you can build a natural mulch pile out there.
Exactly.
Not too far from where I think some other folks may recognize you had some foxes visiting too, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, it was, remarkable. It was just before Easter. And I look out my window one day and I see, two little baby foxes running around near my shed. Before I knew it, six heads had emerged from underneath that shed. And it was absolutely amazing to watch them over the next couple of weeks. The mother would go out hunting during the day and come back and bring a meal, and they'd all get out and they'd be enjoying their meal, and I'm sitting there saying, at some point I'm going to need to go into that shed to get my lawnmower. So I did a little research on foxes and, the noises they make and the mm-hmm. movements they make, and learned that they're not going to be in that location much longer.
Much longer.
Move frequently. And yeah. The last time I saw them was about a week ago, and they actually let me get close enough to videotape them playing, and that was the last time I saw them, about a week ago, and now they're in somebody else's yard because I have a Ring doorbell and I get these alerts, and
okay,
keep seeing these some yep. of my neighbors saying, oh, there's a fox in our yard.
I might guess allowing them to get closer to you, their social distance to that extent was a little bit more than 6 feet.
Oh, yeah. If I tried to get closer than 20 feet, then they would take off.
Yeah.
And if I had my dog with me, forget it. They were hopping under the shed.
Indeed. And with the weather, I think, as we were discussing, I think in another thread somewhere, you haven't been out on the bike outside just yet?
Not yet. You know, I'm still riding indoors. Luckily, I got an elaborate setup over the winter to allow me to ride indoors and actually do group rides with a product called Zwift. So I've been pretty much doing most of my riding in my living room. A little leery about getting out there on the roads without a mask. And I expect when I ordered one for particular for bike riding that I should have in the next couple of days. So hopefully next weekend I can get out on the road and be appropriately covered.
Mm-hmm. So at least via some activities and health, you're maintaining some balance, because unfortunately, as you started saying, yeah, it's kind of hard even to take a break to get away from it, because a lot of things that we would normally do, now we can't.
Yeah, and I can tell you that there are a lot of folks and constituents who are running into some real deep trouble and having some issues. Mostly, I would say the largest piece is unemployment, helping them navigate through that process. The right. call volumes have gone through the roof. You know, and you put it in perspective, we have over 600,000 unemployment claims.
Right.
In Massachusetts. So the population of Massachusetts is about 6.4 million people. So to have 10% of your population on unemployment, that's extraordinary. And that's, you know, the population includes children and retired folks. So,
sure.
You know, the unemployment rate is extraordinarily high. And, you know, it continues to grow every day. So we had an office of the unemployment office had about 50 people fielding phone calls before the coronavirus struck. Quickly ramped up to 500 employees. Now I'm told they have about 1,000 employees handling the phone calls. And, you know, and even with 1,000 employees, folks aren't able to get through. So, you know, they'll call our office and we will help them navigate. You know, it's between the federal programs, helping small businesses and other, you know, pieces of state government. You know, people are calling with ideas for legislation and other issues that they need help with. So we're doing a great deal of constituent services at this point.
Yeah, and that's important stuff. I know even back between 2008 and 2010, I spent the better part of 2 years collecting while I was looking because of that great recession at the time. Not nearly as quite the numbers as we're already seeing now. So it's just, it is indeed staggering. My heart goes out to them.
Yeah, no question.
But we shall get through it. It's just going to matter of, you know, using the onlines, which I haven't heard so much about the onlines not being successful, but clearly getting to talk to somebody to find out, you know, well, how do I do this? How do I do that? Because while the onlines are at least functioning, clearly, are they going to cover every single circumstance? Not necessarily.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the major issues is people, when they file for unemployment, they'll put in some incorrect information about the name of their employer. They'll forget to put comma incorporated or put the wrong name of the company because they know it as such and such, but actually their corporate name is different.
Sure.
What that does is it prevents them from getting into the online system because they don't recognize the employer, so a claim is never set up. So in order to move forward, they need to get into the system, and that's when the phone calls start. So, you know, we have to help them get into the system so that they can take advantage of the online system. And I would say probably 50% of the unemployment calls are from some data that was input incorrectly.
Yeah. Yeah. If we had that central accurate repository, that would be good. We don't quite, I know people even on LinkedIn trying to set up their profile and then trying to determine, again, from the various spellings. And even in my case, most recently, I was working for John Hancock, which internationally is known as Manulife. So was it John Hancock? Was it John Hancock Life Insurance? Was it JHS? Was it, there were a variety of different ways of representing the company, and I had to figure out which one was actually the true one to be aligned appropriately. And then take that as an example and explode it to, you know, the more important piece of getting a check, because the company now has a unique identifier and you got to be with the right one in order to have that process. So,
yeah. Yeah. And when you put it in the context of 600,000 claims, it gets dicey.
Yes, indeed. And of course, the unemployment, since you're not working, you need money. So yeah, it comes home.
Right. I mean, you need to pay the bills. You need to eat. Yeah, you know, it's you take a lot for granted, and you know, when all of a sudden things come to a screeching halt, then you realize the benefits. And you know, I would say a lot of people look at their paycheck at the end of the week and see what's this deduction for DUA. I don't understand what that is. I'll probably never use it. Well, yeah. You know something? It. Thank God we have that protection out there to help in situations just like this.
Agreed. And that's where at least we're fortunate that within constraints, so obviously the bottom of the gold supply is not unlimited, because we still have some fiscal responsibility, but to the extent that the feds at their level and then the state at its level can, you know, extend the periods, you know, from the normal, 13 weeks to beyond that. I remember, I think it was key in my time at the 2008 and 10, it was up to 39 weeks. Who knows what it'll be this time around.
Right. And, you know, I'll tell you, one of the first pieces of legislation that the House had to consider when we were in the state of emergency was, there's typically a 1 week waiting period for any person making a claim for unemployment benefits.
Right.
And knowing that folks needed money immediately, the first bill that we passed was one to waive that 1 week waiting period.
So that's a good segue, since you are, we are all in this state of emergency, but the House is still working, the Senate is still working, legislation is still going on, so that must change some of your daily process, your daily routine. You're still working, but albeit remotely.
Right. Well, it's amazing that, you know, we are still able to move forward and do the work that we need to do. And it has gone really without a hitch. The only thing I can say is that any legislation that goes through either the House or the Senate has to be with unanimous consent, because any one person in either the House or the Senate can stand up and object and bring that bill to a screeching halt. It has happened on a couple of occasions. With legislation that has moved in. So we have to be very careful to make sure that there is universal agreement on the legislation. And I think folks are cognizant of the emergency that we're in and the unprecedented times that we're in. So people have been a little bit more flexible in offering their consent. That certainly, I expect and anticipate, will run dry as some of the matters that come before the legislature tend to get even more complex. So we're beginning to make arrangements as to how the legislature is going to work in the future. We have a caucus tomorrow scheduled for noon, whereby the entire legislature is going to get together in a conference call. And I want you to sit back and imagine 160 people on a telephone call.
That'll be multiple talking screens about, on a Zoom, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be something. But, you know, we're going to talk. Are we going to move to remote voting? Are we going to have folks come into the State House to deliberate and debate? And probably the most important item that we have coming up is the state budget.
Yes.
And actually today, Monday, April 27th, was the day that the House was going to begin deliberation on its budget. It's typically the week after April vacation that we start our budget deliberations, and those sessions run from 9 o'clock in the morning till midnight. And we deal with approximately 1,500 amendments and produce a state budget. Well, obviously that's not happening today. So we're going to talk about how it is that the state legislature is going to get together to get a budget. As you know, under our constitution, we have to have a budget by June 30th. And, you know, getting that done. So the governor did his budget in January. We are supposed to do ours in April. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. No. We'll probably move it into May. But, and then the Senate has to do its budget. And then the two bodies have to get together in a conference committee to, you know, hammer out any differences between the two budgets. And then we send it to the governor's desk. And then the governor has a chance to go through it and issue line item vetoes. And then it comes back to the House to vote on any of those vetoes. So there's a lot of work still to be done. And I know that our cities and towns throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts are waiting to hear from the state as to what level of state aid is going to be available so that cities and towns can do their budgets. So very important times that we're in. And, you know, we're still very much at work.
And I know from prior years, while the contractual and constitutional commitment is by June 30th, realistically, it's actually gone into, in some cases, I think it's a couple of weeks into August, given the timing and the process until, as you say, we really figure it out. You figured out exactly how it's going to happen. It's possible it would go a little bit beyond that prior, you know, mid-August timeframe.
Certainly possible. You know, over and above the June 30th deadline, the session, official session of the legislature comes to an end on July 31 at midnight. So there's even talk of extending that particular deadline.
Sure.
And then, you know, we have elections coming up this fall. So September 1 is the primary.
Yep.
And November 6th, I believe, is the date. The first Tuesday in November is the general election.
Yep.
And so we have to figure out how that's all going to happen. There's legislation pending right now to provide for mail-in voting or extending absentee voting and, you know, having people able to vote absentee for any reason whatsoever. So those are some pieces of the puzzle that we're working out. We don't want to put people in danger having to show up at the polls, but we do want people to exercise the most important civic right that we all have, and that's the right to vote. So we're trying to figure out ways to increase voter turnout.
Absolutely. Because if I recall, having talked with town clerks, Teresa Burr and the assistant Nancy Danello, if I recall correctly, the early voting had been approved for the November election, had not been approved for the primary. Now that still requires, you know, physical presence into the town clerk's office, assuming it's open by then, that'd be one thing. But certainly providing the mail option, we already can do absentee ballot, but whether we send the ballot to everybody or make it certainly accessible, much more so than it is currently, that clearly the turnout, I think, between September and then critically in November is going to be absolutely important overall.
A provision that I'm pushing in that legislation would be to require notice to everyone of the opportunity to vote, and particularly in the primary. So there's been some suggestion that we ought to send ballots to everyone for both the primary and the general. Well, it's easy to send ballots to everyone in the general election, but the primary is party based. So which ballots are you going to send to each of the voters? Who, you know, how do you know who's going to pick up a Democratic ballot, who's going to pick up a Republican ballot, Libertarian ballot, Green Party ballot?
Yeah.
I think at one point we had a Pirate Party. So
I think there's officially 9 from what I recall from the clerk, okay. But oddly too, the largest registration is unenrolled. So what do you do for that one? Because they could theoretically obviously take one of the 2 primary ones, but could take any one of the 9.
Well, the provision that I'm promoting is send a Democratic ballot to those registered Democrats, send a Republican ballot to those registered Republicans, and the same with the other parties. But for the unenrolled, send them a letter indicating to them that the primary is on September 1 and give them a date by which they have to determine which ballot they want. And they either can send that letter back or they can send an email or go online to register to request a ballot to be sent to them.
Sure.
That's the provision that I'm pushing. Some have suggested that all we need to do is leave it out there and let people send in a request for a ballot. But I'm absolutely certain that a lot of people don't understand the process crystal clear, and that will result in a vast downturn in folks turning up. So I think every single person in Massachusetts should get some form of notice, either a ballot or a letter indicating the process for requesting a ballot.
Yeah, I think that's practical and makes the most sense because, otherwise, logistically, the only other choice would be to have one ballot and then have a box at the top that would check. But then that in itself complicates because it would be really messy having the Republican candidates intermixed with the Democratic candidates for the same roles, et cetera. Right.
Invariably, people are going to vote for a Republican on one election and a Democrat on another election.
They pick and choose. Sure.
And that's going to void their ballot.
Yeah.
So, you have to be cognizant of that.
Definitely. So certainly the legislation is still working. Budget certainly is beginning. One of the other pieces, and I think if I recall correctly, you had finished your higher ed tour just before this emergency period, which was convenient at least, because now that would have complicated you completing that round of visits. But higher ed certainly is going to be another arena of concern as the pandemic certainly continues, and then what happens in September and even beyond.
Right. It is quite amazing that, so we started tours in September of 2019 and completed them in early March of 2020. So we visited all 29 public colleges. That includes all of the UMass system, all of the state universities and colleges, and all of the community colleges, 29 in total. Amazingly, we did not get snowed out on any of these visits, and we were able to complete them all as scheduled. And the point of that trip was to get a sense of what our campuses needed and what resources they would need from the budget and ways that we could assist them to produce more students. Massachusetts has the most highly educated workforce in the entire United States, and 72% of all jobs in Massachusetts require some form of a credential beyond a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So higher education is critical for the continued success in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And we wanted to get a firsthand look. And no sooner do we finish our tours that we're hit with a state of emergency, and what the college campuses were doing. And it kind of shocked me at the beginning. They were telling their students, once you go to spring break, do not return to campus. Go directly home. Do not collect $200. Go past go and go right home.
Right.
And I was sitting back there saying, why are they doing this? And, you look back and you say, these college campuses were really ahead of the curve, and they really did the right thing and were a good model for behavior during the COVID crisis. And so now, commencements are canceled, and they're taking steps to figure out, what is best for remote learning. I think we've all seen the weaknesses of doing totally online education. You need that in-person, contact. You need access to lab space. You need access to art, I don't even know what you refer to them. I'm thinking of Mass College of Art has a kiln and burning.
Absolutely.
You need access to these facilities to really complete your education. So the focus right now is on what are these campuses going to do come fall. Mm-hmm. And a very interesting op-ed piece done by the president of Brown University in the New York Times this weekend, providing a roadmap for campuses reopening in September of 2020. And, the more I think of it, the more I like the idea. These campuses are mini cities in and of themselves and could provide some real, good measures for us to look at as to how we can get our largest cities across America back into functioning. And so I would do anything in my power to help and support these campuses getting back to business. Now, they're not going to get back to the same business that they were doing in February and March of 2020. It's going to be a much different campus, but we can bring people back and we can continue the social distancing. And we can continue some safe practices. Let's not have the lecture halls with 200 and 300 people in them.
Right.
Let's meet in smaller groups. Let's reorient. Let's revolutionize higher education and the experience. And let's make it work. And let's show the rest of the country how this can be done in a safe manner.
Yeah, because Chloe, the dorms for one, I know particularly in freshman year, you sometimes ended up with a triple or even a quadruple, and then only the seniors and upperclassmen got into either the singles or the doubles. Social distancing would probably change that considerably. The cafeterias, the lecture halls could still be utilized, but obviously there would be more spacing. So instead of having 200 people into the 200 seats, maybe you only have, call it 70 people in the 200 seats. Everybody's spaced. But then getting into the the labs and the workrooms that you referenced, whether they're kilns on the art side or sculpture places, et cetera, that's where a lot of that educational work is also really needed to happen to complete that particular educational journey. Certainly from an English major perspective, and I was one, you can read and write and, chat around, thoughts and ideas. But if you're a chemist or a biology, getting to that dissecting table, and then in an appropriate circumstance, that's going to be required.
Yeah, and I will say that one of the keys to the success of this will be testing. Testing to see who's been exposed, the antibody test to see who's already had it and whether that will, help prevent them from getting it again, taking temperatures and making sure that folks are healthy on the campuses and perhaps isolating those who are not, who may be sick. There would be ways for dealing with them. But I think the college campuses can be a real model for the success of bringing America back.
Yeah, it's kind of a built-in Petri dish to pick up on that analogy in terms of how could it be done. And obviously we're testing with real lives, so we have to be careful about that too. So
And I don't think anyone is going to be forced into any situation that they don't want to be or where they feel unhealthy. I mean, a lot of A lot of students are coming into this with a big question mark, and some are, you know, considering alternatives. I mean, I've heard folks, rather than going to an urban setting, are making acceptances at a more rural campus, so they won't be exposed. So mm-hmm. you'll see some of that. You know, you'll see some students saying, you know, I think I'm going to take a gap year, and I'll go to school.
Good time to do that. Yes,
2021. Mm-hmm. So you know, there's a lot of options and opportunities out there. You know, we're mindful of that, but you know, we still want to, you know, try to bring folks back. You know, we need the research that goes on at these universities. That's how we're going to get out from under this epidemic, is to get people back into the research labs. And, you know, we certainly want innovative ideas for protective devices for folks. And a lot of good energy comes out of our college campuses. And then on the other hand, you have to look at the financial impact of keeping campuses closed. And I've seen some studies, the most prominent is a recent McKinsey study that showed the financial consequences of campuses not opening in September, mm-hmm. Moving to January of 2021, and then going even further to suggest, here's the financial consequences of moving into September of 2021. And the consequences are dire for campuses. Lowered enrollments and the lowering number of 18 to 21-year-olds who are out there to go to campuses has been on the steady decline for quite some time. Yep. And we know that it's going to get even deeper come 2026. So with these lower enrollments, campuses were in trouble to begin with. You throw COVID-19 on top of that, and it's you know, not a pretty picture. And so we want to help and preserve as many of these institutions as possible, because higher ed represents a very important part of the Massachusetts economy, and it represents a very important part of the success of individuals in life overall.
Yeah, I think it enables us to come full circle to some of our discussion items too, because clearly going back to the budget, if we don't have the campuses reopening, and I know in Boston, it's what, 400,000 to 600,000 students come into the city. I don't know what the number is offhand. Maybe you have that as to, in terms of the statewide totals, but with just the 29 institutions on the Mass level, there's a whole bunch of other private institutions, that's a significant part of our economy.
Yeah, that's from 85 private institutions.
85 private, so that's 100. Right. That's over 100. Yeah,
right. Now, you know, hundreds of thousands of students were sent home in March.
Yep.
And you know, that means that they weren't eating in the restaurants. Their friends and parents weren't visiting to come and spend some time in the hotels. Mm-hmm. There were no entertainment pieces, no lectures, no book tours, you know, no activity. And, you know, folks who had leases on rental properties around the campuses, you know, had to continue paying them. But what's going to happen to the marketplace for rentals when the fall kicks up and nobody's renting
these
apartments that are around the campuses? So the economic fallout can be enormous. And then you top that off, if you don't have this request for these services, this could lead to a wave of layoffs on the campuses.
Sure.
And more people on unemployment, a depressed rental housing market, and lost spending from students and parents who they're not eating in the restaurants, they're not shopping in the stores, or not staying in the hotels. It's an incredible situation that we're facing. So as long as we can do it safely, we ought to consider doing what we can to get these places up and running again.
Yep, safety is paramount, because if we don't have our health, doesn't much matter what else we have at that point.
Without question.
I think we've kind of come back full circle to kind of the legislation, the budget, the impacts, the dominoes are still out there. Things are still changing on a fairly regular basis, if not daily basis. I expect we can continue to have this on a somewhat frequent schedule, and I thank you for that. Do you want to add anything else before we wrap up?
One other area that I just want to raise, bring up, because I think it's important, and that's the arts and culture community.
Yes, key aspect.
Our state's nonprofit cultural organizations contributed $2.3 billion to the state economy last year, and they accounted for 71,000 jobs every year. In 21 million people, they go to the theater, they visit a museum, or they buy a ticket for a concert in the greater Boston area every year. And that's four times the number of people who attend every single home game on Boston's four major sports teams.
Yes,
there are 700 nonprofit art organizations in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and they're suffering a tremendous amount. In our own town, we have the Black Box Theater.
Sure.
We have Dean College has a performance venue.
Yep.
We have the church on Chestnut Street that offers concerts.
Circle of Friends and Live Arts.
Yep. Right. A lot of cultural facilities that also bring people into our community who eat in our restaurants. That's something that we have to, think about and try to support them along the way. I've seen a number of local artists who have taken to Zoom or
Facebook Live, YouTube Live.
Keep things going. Let's keep them in mind, because we need them to survive and thrive, so that we can get our arts and culture back to where it was. And to me, as a musician myself, I constantly think of the benefits of arts and culture to humanity and the betterment of society. And I really want the arts and culture communities to thrive and come back. And, that includes movie theaters or any type of entertainment venue.
Sure.
Because we need those outlets.
Music really is kind of the universal language too. So, yeah.
I've been playing a lot of guitar these days.
Practicing some new tunes to come back.
Yeah.
Ben Gardner's boat gets out there.
Yeah, because we have not been able to get together as a band for, it's got to be 5 or 6 weeks. So, I take that time and just been working on some new stuff, because, having that ability to just grab an instrument and play is really grounding.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, and I know I was going to ask, because clearly I've seen some performers performing, whether, YouTube Live, Facebook Live. So you haven't explored practicing or rehearsing kind of on a Zoom meeting? That would be really complicated, I think, wouldn't it?
We have explored it, and you'd be amazed at how difficult it is, because and I'll give you one quick example, is the latency between communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being off by a millisecond can throw off the timing. And the other thing about Zoom is that when one person speaks, it mutes everybody else. So there's only one person who can talk at a time. So when you have a band that's trying to get five people to play and everybody's sound is muting out the others, it's disastrous. So know there's technology and equipment out there. I don't know that all five members of the band have access to that level of technology to make it happen.
No, and that's a good point. I having experienced in a live setting many years ago, even just a four piece a la chamber, the two violins, the cello and the bass, just the visual eye contact
Yeah.
for each of them to coordinate as to who's doing what. Never mind the listening part, which obviously you can't see that much, but the visual context. And yeah, the latency, absolutely. But the sound, even more importantly, that's the whole thing you're really trying to produce. And yet the sound only comes out one at a time.
Right. So we have thought about it.
Yeah. Well, there's an opportunity for somebody in the tech space. How can we use the Zoom or something like not to create a cacophony, but to create some beautiful music with
The
multiple
tech,
threads?
yeah, the technology is obviously out there because I've seen remarkable performances that have been done, and I know the software is out there, but getting access to it is another
Yeah,
thing.
for another day.
Yep.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for taking your time, sir. I'm
Thank
being
you.
mindful of your time. I know you've got some other things to do, but we'll come back again.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you doing this, and keep up the good work.
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements, and I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is entitled Ernesto Manana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.